Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Tim Leach. Tim is founder and managing director at Risk Oversight Solutions. His focus is promoting the business case for and helping organizations implement strong, management-driven, strategy and objective-centric risk and certainty management. He has received awards for outstanding contributions to the risk and assurance field from CPA Ontario, the IIA, the ACFE, and the OCEG. His work in the field of strategy and risk governance has been published by Harvard and Columbia Universities, London School of Economics, the IIA, the Conference Board, Ethical Boardroom, and many others. So, everybody, today I am really excited and super thrilled to welcome the man, the myth, the legend, the godfather of objective-centered risk management, Tim Leach, to the podcast. If you guys follow my writing or listen to me on the podcast, you know that I have referenced Tim a whole heck of a lot. And I have to credit Tim with inspiring my approach to risk management in the third sector. So Tim, thank you so much for giving some time today to be on the Tolerable Risk podcast.
It's my pleasure, Sabrina. Very much appreciated. I really respect the work you're doing, the sector that you're focused on, charities and nonprofits, I think is one that can truly benefit from the areas that you're exploring and providing a lot of resources to.
Awesome. So today we're going to talk about board purpose, and that has so many different layers to it when you are talking about nonprofits, because a lot of the language that we use in the charity and nonprofit sector is about mission and about purpose. So I'm really looking forward to seeing where our conversation goes today. But before we get into that, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words for people who aren't familiar with you? What's your background and what's your focus?
Okay, sure. That's a great opportunity and I appreciate it. Certainly, I'd encourage you to have a look at LinkedIn. All you need to do is put Tim Leach and you'll get to my profile. If you're not familiar with my work, it's a good place to get a little longer understanding of my background, because at this point in my life, at 68, there's actually quite a lot of backgrounds. Started off life thinking I wanted to be a lawyer, and then I decided I wanted to be a CPA. I got my chartered accounting designation way back in 1981. Thought I wanted to be a controller and pursued that, starting in internal audit. So I learned a lot about internal auditing, and I started with Westinghouse, but moved to Gulf Canada Resources. So I learned about internal audit in a Fortune 500 world. Then I did line accounting with Gulf Canada Resources in Calgary. So I got to do some big league things like $50 million journal entries, and really learned about life in the big time when it comes to financial reporting. But during that time, I had started in internal auditing, and then I was on the other side of the desk. And my conclusion was, is that didn't make a lot of sense after I had experienced the internal audit side. And that was when we decided we'd propose control and risk self-assessment at Gulf Canada. We said, look, management is responsible for objectives, whether it's drilling oil wells, producing oil and gas, producing financial statements, complying with Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, rather than us doing 10 or 20 audits a year and giving them to the board. Why don't we get the people that own the objectives we think are really important to do self-assessment? And we proposed that in 1985. The CEO liked it, and literally it was a pivotal turning point in my life. We started to write about it. Other companies got excited about it. We started to give speeches. I was a proponent of objective-centric self-assessment, meaning you start with the most important objectives. Long story short, big companies got really excited about the notion of control risk self-assessments. And the control risk self-assessment had a life of its own. The IIA got behind it. They sponsored the second annual conference on it. Huge gatherings of people excited about the notion of management accountability for thinking about risks and controls. And then Sarbanes-Oxley kind of wiped it away. In the meantime, I got into the software business. I was approached by Paisley Consulting, top three in the world. They wanted to buy my company. I sold to Paisley. I was their chief methodology officer from 2004 to 2007. And since then, I've been working on my second generation of thinking, which, you being a student, background of what I promote, you'll know it says the way forward is strong, first line, objective-centric, demand-driven.
Excellent. So people who are listening right now might be saying, Tim has just such a private sector background. Why is Sabrina having Tim on to talk about nonprofits? And the reason is because I think the topic today is very relevant for nonprofits. It's as relevant as it is for for-profits. The way that it shakes out might be slightly different, but board purpose is something that needs to be talked about more, thought about more, focused on. And in the third sector, it's just as important to have that tone at the top of the board. So Tim, when you write about or when you talk about board purpose, it's a very specific thing for you. Tell us, what is board purpose? What does it mean to you? What does it mean for organizations?
Okay. You're correct from what I said. It sounded very private sector, but the reality is my background. I've done a huge amount of work in government at the federal, provincial, and municipal levels, but also with not-for-profits. The general auditor of Alberta, for example, hired me to train all of the audit committees of all of the crown corporations in Alberta. We've also got case studies that I can share implementing the methodology in charities, the Ottawa Humane Society, the Ontario Deaf and Blind Association. So my interest in boards is not just about private listed companies. It's much broader than that. It's the board of any entity, be it a profit, a charity, a not-for-profit, a government entity. So the notion of, if you think about, there is a framework out there called the IIA Three Lines Model 2020, and they use the title, they have a box at the top, which is, I think, titled Governance Oversight, but they specifically chose the word so that it would cover the kind of entities that you're talking about, as well as your more traditional Fortune 500s, your listed public companies and charities. But charity boards and not-for-profits can be complex because they're all incorporated somewhere. So those incorporated jurisdictions bind the duties of those boards. So when I write about purpose for the boards, I'm keen to say, this is what I recommend the board adopt as its purpose. But wherever they're incorporated, it's highly unlikely the incorporating jurisdiction has defined a purpose anything similar to what I've proposed. So that's kind of the context. And I've written for board publications for many, many years. Ethical Boardroom Conference, Board Director Notes, Harvard Governance Flog, Columbia Law School, an article I authored with a professor at Lehigh, who was the first professor to build a governance course. We wrote one of the first in the world about board oversight of corporate culture. That article is about boards just as well as it is about companies.
So if we want to incorporate the concept of board purpose into how boards operate, what's the definition? What's the first thing they should be thinking about?
Well, let's start with what happens in real life. In real life, boards have charters, and those charters will, in my experience, most charters will state the things the board will do. They don't state the purpose. And there's a word in French, which is raison d'être. What does the board see as its reason for existence? So when we look at that, and I would encourage readers to download, I wrote an article for Ethical Boardroom, which is an easy download. The title is Clarity on Board. It was a 2021 article. It's about 7 pages long. It references excellent OSEG work. OSEG is the old Compliance and Ethics Group, is the acronym. The article has one of, I think, in my mind, it's probably the most famous visual that OSEG ever developed about the role of board. And they show the entity pursuing between what looks like two railway tracks. The lower is the voluntary boundaries, and the upper is mandated boundaries, which are defined by law. And so if you were to download my article, Clarity on Board, you'll see what I propose as a statement of what I think board purpose should be. But I start by saying, in my experience, and I've been at this 40 years, I encourage you to go read the charter of your board of directors. you may have to read the charter of all of the subcommittees because sometimes the board itself doesn't have much in a charter. So yeah, you read those documents and say, hasn't that board communicated to stakeholders what our board believes is their reason for existence? And I don't mean we review plans and we review audit reports and we review quarterly financials and annual financials and we review the auditing statements or the draft auditing statements and through them. Those are things that you're going to do. They're not the purpose of it. So what my article explores is what is the purpose. Now I refine that definition that's in that article and I'm going to read it. This is my statement opposed for purpose. Board ensures the company has clear purpose and appropriate supporting value creation and value preservation objectives, including ESG objectives, if any. Board ensures management pursues those objectives effectively while operating with a level of risk/certainty acceptable to the board. So that's my take on what a really great board would accept as a purpose. At this point, I haven't found any that I can see that they read my article and they said, he nailed it. Let's adopt that and we'll publish it in our annual report.
Well, maybe after the podcast today, people will, right? And so I think what you're suggesting is that boards should feel empowered to not just rubber stamp or tick box, but to ask questions, ask for data, ask for additional evidence. As I've had other people on the podcast say, you know, look under the hood and not necessarily just take the information that leadership and management hands them, but, you know, read between the lines. Is that what you're suggesting?
So what you had posed in your question, you're framing it in terms of things the board should do as activities. And what I'm suggesting is clear purpose statement that in two or three sentences captures why should they do that? What's the reason for existence of the board in terms of what should a stakeholder expect to be different in a company that has a board versus a company that has no board? And that's what the purpose is trying to do. And in my experience, very few boards have proposed a statement of board purpose. And I think that may well be because lawyers have told them not to, because in a litigious environment, if you say why you exist, things go wrong. You are more into litigation than you are. You just have to say proof that you reviewed audit reports. You reviewed the output of a risk officer. You reviewed the draft strategic plan and you ask management questions. So it's easier to prove you did what you're supposed to. All you're supposed to do is a series of activities. If there is a defined outcome you're supposed to ensure is achieved, you have more legal liabilities. So as I can understand why boards don't want a state purpose. So some boards may want to have secret purposes where they don't disclose it to anybody but themselves, then they have that in an in-camera discussion. But what I'm encouraging to do is think long and hard about why are we here? What is it we're supposed to accomplish as outcomes?
So you just gave reasons why people might not do what you are suggesting that they do. And litigation can be a real scary one. And particularly for small organizations, they'll go, well, okay, I'm totally not going to come up with a board purpose statement now. Tim just scared my pants off. My question, though, is why should people be doing this? What is the benefit? What is the value? What outweighs the fear or the concern that they may have? What will the organization benefit from if the board has clear purpose?
Well, in my experience, and I, long, long time ago, I was on the board of a not-for-profit. In my experience, most boards that choose to go on not-for-profits where they're unpaid, most boards, particularly charities, they have a strong affinity connection to the purpose of the entity, whether that's Save the Children or UNICEF, you name it. Usually, people that are unpaid that volunteer their expertise and time, they're committed to the aims of the organization. So they should be the people that are prepared to sit down and agree with their other board members. Why are we here? What is our reason for existence?
So when you're talking about board purpose, you're talking about the board themselves, not the purpose of the organization that they are working with, but the purpose of the board itself.
Yes.
And so then how would this differ from your standard fiduciary duties, right? I mean, you've got your duty of loyalty, your duty of care, you've got your core fiduciary duties. Why would a board need something other than that?
Okay, so this is all evolving right now under case law. Particularly Delaware case law. There's very little case law of not-for-profits and charities. Most of them have never been tried for board negligence. If they have been tried for board negligence, they had insurance and it was quietly settled. So there's very little information we can get about people that have litigated against boards of not-for-profits. The question then becomes is, what is the legal standard of care? Now, you rhymed off a bunch of words that tend to be Delaware duty of care. Or they may not apply at all if you're a Canadian charity. So the best I can offer is generalities. Most of these boards care. They care about what that charity's trying to do. And ideally, they care that the resources that donors, whether the donors be government funding a not-for-profit, or whether they be donors that are ponying up their own personal funds as a sign of commitment to the charity, they got to decide, do they want to be truly accountable? And do they want to convince donors that this is a great place to donate money because it's well governed? And I like what they claim they're going to do. I'm the donor and I'm saying that. I like that. But can I trust them to spend it wisely and prudently? And as much of the money as possible will actually end up realizing what the entity says is their purpose. So if you remember what I said in my draft statement of board purpose is, one of the first is to ensure the entity they oversee has clear. And I would suggest that in many companies that hasn't occurred, and in many not-for-profits and charities that hasn't always been very clear. So in our case studies, even when we work with somebody like the Humane Society, when we started analyzing the mission of the Humane Society, the conclusion wasn't at all clear what the purpose of the Humane Society was. So then they try and facilitate a clearer statement of purpose. And I'm suggesting the board should feel it's their job to do that. And I'm suggesting the board should ensure clarity of purpose of the entity they oversee. And I'm suggesting the board should oversee that management of that entity has developed appropriate strategic supporting objectives that will result in achievement of the entity's purpose. So that's my definition of board purpose, but it starts with ensuring the entity they oversee has clear. Once they've done that, I'm suggesting the board has an obligation to ensure that management pursues that purpose of supporting objectives effectively.
Let me just go back to, again, the purpose of the board. So what you're saying is that if boards have a clear purpose statement, a clear purpose understanding, it strengthens governance overall of the organization that will then kind of trickle down into the governance and the oversight of the entity, which they're charged with these different fiduciary duties that we had talked about. And in a way, this can be a good selling point for strong governance for donors, for funders. It's something that you can point out. People who listen to my podcast a lot know that I talk a lot about being a responsive and responsible partner. So funders a lot of times are looking for people or for organizations that run responsive programming to the types of things that they want to support, but also that they can demonstrate that they are a responsible partner so that the resources that are given to them will be used wisely. So what you're saying is that this can be an advantage if boards are very clear about their purpose and then how that board purpose links up with risk management, that can strengthen the responsible element when it comes to partnering with funders and donors.
Absolutely. I can't stress it enough. In a world where a donor has literally tens of thousands of places they can donate money to or support, they should care passionately about the risk governance in the entity they're going to transfer some of their money. So yes, what you've said is absolutely right. For example, one of our case studies was Ontario Deaf and Blind Foundation. A large percentage of their money comes from the government. The government should care passionately that the charity has effective risk governance. Why? Because that's are you going to ensure that the purpose of the entity is being pursued effectively with the oversight of a caring and prudent board?
So tell us then, how does this board purpose statement or this board purpose concept lead into risk management? How are those things linked?
Okay, so in the Idaho Clarity on Board, there is a proposed draft statement of the purpose of a risk function and internal audit function. So it could be a combined role. It could be each of them has separate distinct roles. But I have proposed that the number one reason for existence of audit and risk functions, be it in a not-profit, a charity, or the largest listed company in the world, is ensure the CEO and board receive materially reliable and timely information on the current risk/certainty that the company's materially reliable, that the company's top strategic value creation objectives and value preservation objectives are achieved while operating with a level of risk certainty acceptable to the CEO and board. So simply put, what am I saying? I'm saying internal audit and risk, their primary reason for existence is to ensure the CEO and the board, and I have to emphasize both. It's not enough that the CEO know, but the board has to be, both are aware of the risks being accepted. Those risks could relate to compliance with the law. If we look at the current McDonald's litigation against the board, it was about, does the board have an obligation to be aware of the entity's precautions to ensure that staff and suppliers aren't being sexually harassed by the executive of the company? In the McDonald's case, it's the CEO, ironically the chief people officer at the time, are both named in the suit. So if we decide that that's a societal objective that's important, do boards believe they have an obligation to ensure that the executives of the company that they oversee aren't sexually harassing staff? I don't think it's at all clear that a lot of boards believe that that's their job right now. However, under the definition that I proposed, if he felt that that's a really important objective, it would be defined as such. The board would tell audit and risk, we want information on how well we're doing on that dimension, and it would be their job to produce it.
So this is a really interesting angle, and I appreciate that the McDonald's litigation is about sexual harassment, but I want to just take a step back and talk about the flow of information from internal audit, from risk to the board. Because a lot of times in medium size, maybe organizations, the risk function may be a middle management function. It may be buried, and the risk function is reporting to the CFO or the COO or HR maybe even. And so the episode that I had with Horst Simon, you know, he talks about how the information, as it flows up, it becomes sanitized. So are you saying then that as part of board purpose, boards should be almost insisting that they're getting information directly from critical roles like risk, like compliance, instead of having it be filtered through some of these other roles that may sanitize it in a way?
Yes, with caveats. And the caveats are, I've trained literally tens of thousands of heads of audit and heads of risk. A message I always tell them is find out whether your CEO is okay with you examining and studying particular areas, and are they okay with you reporting your conclusions on the state of risk and control to the board? If the answer is no, the CEO is not, I just tell them point blank, look, unless you are independently wealthy and are just interested in the good of society, you have to be realistic. If you try to report information the CEO does not want shared with the board, they're going to sign. They have the power, and the board, in my experience, is unlikely to support you.
And that is something that I think risk and compliance folks have to come to terms with. And with risk and compliance having just such more of a highlight and a finer point put on it in the third sector, I think that everybody who's interested in going into that area has to be very well aware that they're going in on thin ice sometimes. Exactly what you said, Tim. You're not always going to have the board that's going to have your back. You You may not even get an opportunity to talk to the board about your concerns. And if you are speaking up about things that organizations don't want to know about, there has been a great article that's been circulating around LinkedIn about FOFO, fear of finding out. And a lot of organizations suffer from that. So risk and compliance folks may be in precarious situations. So excellent point there, Tim.
It's top of mind right now. So the Wells Fargo case, which I haven't discussed, I mentioned McDonald's. It's a very important decision. It's the office of the controller of the currency is right now recommending that the chief risk officer and the chief internal auditor, I think the chief risk officer, they're recommending a fine $10 million. And they're recommending fines in the many millions against two different chief audit executives. The OCC is saying those people had a duty to report to the board and they didn't fill their duty. So they're going to be fined for negligence for not doing it. Now, that environment is very specific. That is financial services firm that is responsible as a primary regulator to the OCC, Office of the Controller of the Currency, which defines very specific expectations of the players and the entities it regulates. So it's not a normal case in the sense that this isn't just common decision alleging negligence. There is no cases I'm aware of where negligence has been alleged against an officer who is a chief audit executive or a chief risk officer. And there's a reason for that. They usually don't have a lot of money. So even if you believe passionately they've been negligent in their duty, it isn't worth suing unless, and this is a big unless they're an officer of the corporation that's covered by director and officer insurance. Now, I'm trying to get some statistics, but I'm guessing that a very tiny percentage of chief risk officers and chief audit executives are defined as officers of the corporation. So this is a key area of law that is currently being, I suppose, litigated and evolving, and it will change. Charities, it would probably be their wild frontier with virtually no guidance what the responsibility of a chief internal auditor of a charity is. You'd have to go to the incorporated jurisdiction and see is there any liability in law, assuming that it's not pure criminal conduct. So it's a complex area, but one that's evolving. And again, back to if you're not-for-profit charity sector, if I'm a donor, I want some comfort that the board is on top of and running a good ship, quite simply. And if I'm not confident the board is running a good ship, I'm not going to be keen to donate money. And smaller people may not have the same level of expertise in order to discern that. So they may donate large amounts of their money to charities that are run very poorly and the boards are not doing a good job overseeing.
But we don't want to necessarily be hemmed in simply by compliance, right? Because what you're talking about with board purpose, if you just limit yourself to compliance, then you're going back to what you were talking about. What is the board going to do? Not the why are they doing it. So I agree. We can look at the law, but the law is only going to tell us the minimum standards. It sounds like what you are advocating for is something that's more dynamic and something that is above the minimum standards.
Okay, so great point. So last year, you may not be aware, but the National Association of Corporate Directors has a huge, really blue chip, blue ribbon commission entity that is trying to explore whether board practices are outdated. And the purpose is much more what you've described. What should a board, a good board, want to do and to have as a purpose and to discharge as a purpose? Now, that commission, I think, probably has more of a for-profit to it, but many of the principles are applicable for not-for-profits and charities. And many of the big charities have people that serve on boards of for-profits, and the charities specifically recruit them because of that board experience. Long and short of it is if we take the notion that not-for-profits and charities have boards that care, they care about the board's purpose, they care about the entities, then this is advice to them. These are people that will, of their own volition, do this. Whether they publicly disclose it or not is a separate decision. But do they believe in their heart of hearts that boards should be accountable for the kind of purpose that I describe. And if they do, then they should be asking for different kinds of information than most boards get today.
So really the advice here is for boards to ensure that they are being active and aware of what their role is and the why behind what they're doing. And I like that this isn't necessarily something like you're saying that they need to put in writing, that they need to publish. It might be great if they do, because it demonstrates accountability. It demonstrates a positive tone at the top. But overall, what you're saying is there's value in boards really being clear about their purpose for existence instead of just the rubber stamping of audit findings and convening a meeting once or twice a year in order to meet the regulatory requirements.
Yeah. So I like to try and simplify when I can. I'm encouraging boards to ask two simple questions. They're not hard questions. This is the board chair asking the CEO, what are the entities most important strategic value creation and value preservation objectives? That's question one. And who will we be getting information on the risk/certainty these objectives will be achieved with a level of risk that's acceptable to us from? That's it. Two questions. So the whole face of risk governance can change with two simple questions from a board chair. Now, here's the problem. I'm not sure a lot of boards want it. Yes.
I'm really glad that you brought up those two questions, Tim, because I was going to ask the normal question that I ask in the podcast, which is what would be some questions that you would encourage board members to ask? And so those are great. So the first one being, what is the strategic value creation element of the organization? And the second one is, what is the risk awareness and is the risk level acceptable to the organization, to the board? So those are two very clear, great questions. And I appreciate you simplifying them because that's going to be helpful for the listeners.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of those two questions. I think those two questions all by itself, the CEO could ask this in 5 minutes. It's not hard. Are they prepared for what the CEO tells them as an answer? I would suggest many boards would be fairly dismayed when they got the answer. Boards are getting the usual stuff, which is the financial reports, the quarterlies, the annual. But as we expand into ESG, and if we take the McDonald's case, did the McDonald's board see it as their responsibility to ensure the CEO and the chief people officer were not sexually harassing people because of their position of power?
And I think this comes back to, again, what I was talking about, the theatrics, sort of, I don't know what else to say, between boards and CEOs, where exactly what you said, do they actually want to hear it or do they just want to hear what they want to hear? And I guess for me, that comes back to boards being real. And again, the fear of finding out. And I would hope that the boards for nonprofits have a little bit of a lower threat of litigation, right? Because we're dealing with a nonprofit here. We're not dealing with a Fortune 500 company. And so they are more willing to be bold and be brave and be real and have these frank conversations and ensure that they are hearing the information from what you said, the person or the role or the people who are gathering it and establishing what is risky and what is not. And so I guess ensuring that open line of communication and the transparency between the board and the other roles in the organization, the board should not be this organization behind a curtain. They should be accessible. And I think if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly, that should be an element of board purpose as well.
Yeah, it goes to your comment about, is this the theater? The reality is I've worked with literally thousands of companies in terms of the people I've trained, and I've worked with boards and I've worked with management leadership teams. So I get to observe the interaction. One of the first things I always start with in major engagements is I want to see the board minutes and info packages for the last few years. So I want to see what level of candidness and what management is talking to the board about and what they're not talking to the board about, because I get a pretty good indication of perhaps what you said is there theater involved, or is management genuinely using its best judgment to provide truly meaningful information on what the company is doing and how it's pursuing its objectives and the risks that it's taking in terms of management? When we take something like the Wells Fargo case, it went on for for almost 10 years, I think, in total. But it started with the CEO driving incredibly aggressive sales campaign, and literally people were going to lose their jobs if they didn't hit certain targets to open accounts. No surprise, even my most junior students would recognize that there was a huge risk that people would falsify and do bad things in order to not lose their jobs. It's just standard human nature. Was the CEO told when they started to put that level power and force on a comp system, was the board told at the same time there was a level of risk that went with this strategy? Well, the harsh reality is most audit departments and most risk departments have not been allowed to participate in strategic planning much at all. So the Wells Fargo case is the classic where some of the biggest risks were actually out of bounds, probably for the chief risk officer and the chief audit executive, if we take a pure theory approach. However, from a pragmatic approach, it probably became pretty clear to them that if they try to report that kind of information to the board, that their tenure could well be very short.
Absolutely. And that's what I think we were talking about earlier. As a risk and compliance person, what do you stand for? Do you stand to protect the organization? Do you stand for your own values and ethics and morals? And sometimes those things can be in conflict and really tough decisions have to be made.
In many charities, the reality is we're not talking about having these big major structures and the luxury of even having a head of audit. So those charities, those kind of organizations, they need pragmatic ways to get reliable information feed to the board. So the challenge is there inexpensive ways for a not-for-profit to build information systems that gets better information to the boards? Well, I'm going to suggest the first thing is the board needs to be blunt and really clear with the CEO what information they want and the consequences if the board finds out the CEO has blocked data feed to them.
Yeah, exactly. That was going to be my point, was I don't think that charities need to generate massive internal systems or spend a lot of money. I think that charity organizations are mostly small enough that the line of communication between the person or team that is managing that and the board is probably one layer away, right? Or maybe two layers away at the most. So I don't think it actually needs to be complicated. There just has to be transparency and there has to be trust. And I agree with you. I think the cheapest way for organizations to approach this is for the board to directly ask for it and to ask to hear from that person and don't have that fear of finding out.
And hence my two simple questions. I wrote those specifically that the chair of a small charity could ask the managing director of that charity those questions, or the chair of the biggest company in the world would ask the CEO those same two questions. So I'm a big advocate of let's start with those two simple questions. What's the entity's purpose in supporting value creation and value preservation objectives? What are the most important things that'll make us successful or put us in the ditch? And who's going to tell me about the state of risk linked to them?
Yeah, those are brilliant. What would be some parting advice or some parting thoughts for small to medium-sized charities, board members, trustees who want to integrate purpose into their board existence? Final thoughts on this topic.
Well, pragmatically, I think it's just start with, have we actually agreed amongst ourselves, being the board, what our purpose is? Have that discussion. And I don't mean the charter, which is a list of 12 things they're going to do each year. I mean, what's the purpose of the board? And ideally, it wouldn't be framed in duty of care and legalistic words. It would be a clear statement. Why does the board believe it's there? What's its reason for existence?
Yeah, I like, again, the why and not necessarily the what.
Absolutely. Stay away from the how to and focus on the why does this board exist? What is it our stakeholders expect from us being the board?
Great. Thank you so much, Tim, for your time today. So if people want to reach out to you and get in touch with you, learn more about all the work that you're doing, not just on board purpose, but objective-centered risk management and everything else, where can they find you in the wide, wide world?
Google ought to be sufficient. The last time I tried Googling Tim Leach Risk Oversight Solutions, they should get about 40 pages of ways to get to me, or just go to our website or go to LinkedIn. LinkedIn has a contact page, and because I am in the business of providing advice and training and support, charity should be aware that I have made a public promise. I share a huge amount of my materials with charities free, and I'm prepared to give some advice to those that are keen without the normal consulting type charges or find a cheap way to help them. So I do pride myself. I believe I'm at a stage in my career that if I can give back to charities that have great causes that I believe in, then I'll try my best to help them, or at least find a cheap way to help them.
Excellent. So everybody heard that Tim is ready to help the third sector. We are thrilled to hear that and have you be an honorary member of the third sector. So thank you so much, Tim, for your time today and for talking about this really interesting area, this concept of board purpose. And I definitely want to have you back on the podcast to talk more about risk and how the third sector can handle risk better.
Well, thanks to you too. Big supporter of your commitment to making the world a better place so that we and my children and my children's children have a place they can live in where people care about other people and want to do good things.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tim. So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.